Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about sex.
If you're into vaginas, you're going to love today's podcast. Coming up, vaginas, labiaplasty, squirting, the G-spot, multiple orgasms, how pleasure raises your IQ, and cunts and other conversations. Don't turn off until I say we're done. Hello, this is Catherine Devaney here, deep in the heart of the People's Republic of Moreland at the Atheist Kibbutz. You are joining me for Stay On Your Flower, and joining me is Cindy Darnell, sexologist, sex therapist, sex educator, and founder and creator of Pleasure Salon Melbourne. And she's here with us today, and wherever you are listening to us, when you're going to feel like you are listening to that great conversation down the end of the dinner party that you wish that you could just kind of stretch your ear into, because we're going to be talking about female anatomy. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you, Catherine. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Now, where do we start with female anatomy?
Well, I suppose...
Because vaginas. Yeah. That's all people think. Mm. You say female anatomy and they're talking the big vajayjay.
Yeah, they do think about the vagina. And the vagina is one part of the female anatomy, a very important part, I might add. But there's so much more going on downstairs for a lot of women, and I suppose I just really want to preface throughout the course of today that when I'm talking about women, I'm talking about women who are born identifying as women with female anatomy and that kind of thing. So there are so many different kinds of pussies and vulvas, and female anatomy is a combination of lots of different parts that we're going to have a chat about today.
Do you think that the female genitals generally are much more varied and different to your bloke stuff?
No, I think it's equally as varied. I mean, having seen as many vulvas and cocks as I've seen
and
over my
many?
Life.
Have a stab. No pressure.
No pressure.
Like, if you had to...
We'd be going into the hundreds of all sorts.
See,
so in my professional roles, I've seen a lot.
And run through the... could help the listener understand where you're coming from when you say your professional roles.
So I have worked with a lot of sex workers and that kind of thing. So I've had the pleasure of being able to have very frank conversations and very intimate sort of moments of being able to see and experience people's sexuality in a broad range of capacities. So in that capacity, that's certainly been a lot of it. And in addition, through my studies and my qualifications, I've studied lots of different anatomical pictures, as well as had my own personal experiences, which has, you know, allowed me to see a broad range of cocks and pussies, and that it never ceases to amaze me. I've never seen one that I haven't been fascinated by that is equally as stunning and fabulous in its glory, regardless of its size or its colour.
You might be able to see behind me, there's a picture of the anatomy up on my kitchen door.
The white one?
Yeah, and I think it was a grade one. One of my kids in grade one was drawing it all out and came home and said, "Mum, when you're talking about what you're looking at, it's not the vagina, it's the vulva."
Nice
you
work.
You don't hear much about the vulva, but that's what we're all looking at, isn't it?
It is. When you're looking at a woman when she's got her legs open, what you're looking at without opening anything up, when it's just that straightforward view between the legs, that is the vulva. The bit at the front, the triangle at the front, the map of Tassie, if you will, that is that's sort of the pubic mound. That's the sort of the medical name for it. But that's kind of the front where the hair may or may not have been, should be, could be, might be, depending on what your persuasion is. So the underneath, the undercarriage, that's the vulva, and the front is the pubic mound.
So you've got the pubic mound, you've got the vulva, you've got the clitoris.
So the vulva is made up of the two sets of lips, the big lips and the small lips, labia majora, labia minora.
Yep.
For just sake of ease, we'll just call them big lips and small lips today, I think. Mm. And so that's what the vulva is made up of. When you start to open the lips, the bigger lips and the smaller lips inside, that's where you'll see the opening to the vagina. You'll also see the urethra, and you'll also see the clitoris, which, again, these are all different shapes and sizes in different women. They're often more or less in a similar placement, but the size, the coloration, and the fragrance can be quite different in different women.
I saw an exhibition at Mona down in Tasmania, the Museum of Old and New Art, Cunts and Other Conversation, which is 150 sets of cunts.
Is it the wall installation?
It is a wall.
I think I saw it.
It's amazing. It's plaster casts of all of these cunts. And no, Tony Abbott's not there. And if you want to if you want to hassle me personally about the word cunt, it's a homophone. When I was growing up, I really wasn't very familiar with what was going on downstairs. Mm. And I had heard about squatting over a mirror. I vaguely remember doing it. I don't think I realised there was more than one. I knew there was a hole that you weed out of, mm-hmm. and there was a hole that you pooed out of, and there was a hole that you had sex with and your babies came out of. I think I didn't realise that the urethra was there too. I'm wondering if I'm the only one about, as a little girl, going, I'm weeing out of my vagina. That was never really clear to me. And sure. This is one of the parts of sex education. In some ways, it's just not explicit enough.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. And I think often with little boys, they have the advantage of having everything on the outside.
Yeah.
So they can see where everything's coming out of. And as young girls, we don't get that opportunity unless we actually make the conscious effort to squat over a mirror and have a look, which, by the way, I think is essential. I think it's one of the most important things to do, to become familiar with your own anatomy, because at least that way you can actually see how your body works. And it's fascinating.
It is, but because the male bits are all out, mm-hmm. we're generally quite familiar with them, and so are other boys and so are girls. Mm. They will often have seen heaps and heaps more penises and scrotums than they ever have vaginas by the time they get to 13, 14, 15, 16.
Definitely,
so they might have seen their own a lot of time, but not other people, other women. And the ones that they do are generally in pornography or in educational books, which don't really make it very clear what's going on. I really didn't know where the urethra kind of fit
exactly.
in.
And I suppose too, often when we are looking at sex education, from terms of it's, a lot of the time it's still taught with an emphasis on reproduction, which is a whole other issue. But because the urethra doesn't necessarily feature in reproduction, and often it doesn't necessarily feature in, and I'll use inverted commas, conventional sex, it can be important in other aspects of sexuality. But you wouldn't be the only one. I would actually probably suggest that a lot of younger women or women of many ages, unless they've really actually studied female anatomy, probably don't know where the pee comes out of.
So when you see Cunts and Other Conversations, you've got 150 plaster casts of different cunts, and they are virgins, nuns, Muslims, Christians, young, old, everything. You can also go to the bookshop and buy soaps of these plaster casts.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There would have your Christmas presents.
Yeah.
Drama's been sorted right there.
If I had
got
known
names.
That.
What's really funny is two of them, one of them is Catherine and one of them is Elizabeth, and my sister's name is Elizabeth, and I took photographs of these two soap cunts just kind of next to each other.
Nice.
It's really important for both males and females to be around the whole anatomy thing.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you need to, I think, have a familiarity with yourself and have a sense of ease and comfort, at the very least, with yourself, especially when you start, and you're learning to start playing around with other people. And also because in the same way that we are familiar with our hands, we're familiar with our feet, we will sit and examine every line on our hands, the shape of our nails, the texture of our nails. Why don't we do that with our genitals?
Mm.
It's only because there's this shame and stigma that we believe, or we're led to believe, that our genitals are dirty and that there's no need to look at them because that's only for where the wee comes out of. And I would argue that that's an absolute crock, because our genitals are one of, not the only, but one of the main sources of pleasure that we have access to for the duration of our lives, from when we're young until when we're in the grave. And I think we need to celebrate that more.
So we've got the anatomy down. I want to ask about normal vaginas. We've seen this huge rise in people knowing what other people's, well, not normal vaginas, but normal genitals of women. Mm-hmm. We've gone through the anatomy. People are worried about how they look. There's a huge rise in labiaplasty. Mm-hmm. I think porn and hair removal has made it possible for people to see lots of different genitals and wonder if theirs is okay. What's okay? What's a normal cunt look like?
Well, there is no such thing as a normal one. That's the first thing I would say. There are similarities. Well, there are similarities. You know, they've all got lips and things, but the size, the colour, the texture, the thickness of the skin, the way that the person that's connected to the vulva responds to the way that she likes to be touched. Does she like a lot of friction? Does she like a lot of pressure? Does she like a lot of lubrication? Does she like not much at all? All of these things make each vulva different. And so this idea that we're aiming for one set image, it's like assuming that everybody likes big cocks. Some people like big cocks, some people like small cocks, some people like all cocks. It's really not, you know, you may or may not have a preference to what is something that you like, but ultimately, you know, what you've got to work with is what you've got to work with. I know a lot of people have very strong opinions about labiaplasty in terms of women who are going and having this procedure done for a multitude of reasons. I personally think that women should be able to have control over their bodies regardless of what that means. I would encourage someone to think very deeply about taking on a procedure like that if that's what they were going to do, in the same way that I would actively encourage somebody to really consider getting a tattoo or getting breast enhancement or getting Botox or whatever it is that they're into. I think this idea of women's bodies being so heavily politicized that they take the power away from the individual, and I don't necessarily think that's a great thing. And I'm talking about it from an individual point of view. Of course, we need to have ongoing discussions about the role of sexuality within feminism. Because I work therapeutically with individuals, that's the way I look at it. I look at it on a case-by-case basis. So depending on what a woman's motivations would be for wanting to do something like that, I would need to work through these things with her step by step to work out whether or not that really is going to be the right thing for her to do. I would never point blank say yes, it's right, or no, it's wrong, because I don't see the world, and I certainly don't see sexuality as black and white. There are so many shades of grey, and that's what makes sexuality so fascinating and also makes it so that we will never really understand everything, and I find that incredibly exciting.
Mm. See, people will say, well, there's these huge dangers with surgery, but there's also dangers of people not feeling confident to have sex and live out that part of their life.
The mental health implications can be really, really vast, especially when it comes to body image.
I want to ask two things. One of them is about the smell and taste of vaginas and cunts and pussies and big lips and small lips and little men in the boats. What pussy perfume and things like that, how should it smell? How should we approach the smell taste thing? Now, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Before, like, I've just asked you three questions at once. A guy once told me they taste different depending on the colour of your hair.
Wow.
Blondes, brunettes,
I haven't heard that one. I haven't heard that one. I don't think so. I think it certainly has a lot to do with your diet, definitely. How much alcohol you consume, whether or not you smoke, where you're at in your cycle, whether or not you're pregnant, hormonal changes, all of those things make a difference. So, yes, they have a variety of smells and, yes, they have a variety of flavours. The general rule of thumb, I would say, to anybody who's concerned that theirs might not be, again, normal, I don't want to use that word, would be...
acceptable or... It's hard to find the right word.
I can't think of another word, but, I mean, normality when it comes to pussies... Let me just say there's a rainbow of possibilities. So
I'm just thinking about it like your 15-year-old girl out there who's going to have her first experience of cunnilingus, and she's feeling like, is it okay? Does it smell okay? Does it taste okay? Mm-hmm. How do you know? And if you think it's not good or okay, what can you do about it? And what shouldn't you do?
Yeah. So as a 15-year-old who's had no sexual experience whatsoever, in that the risk of her having contracted any kind of disease or virus is zero because she hasn't had any partners, I would say that her vagina smells perfectly acceptable, exactly as it is. You only start running the risk of having really, really bad smelling pussy if you've got an infection.
Mm.
And if it's that bad, and it's often accompanied with a discharge and something like that, if the smell is so vile, then chances are you do have an infection and you need to get yourself off to the doctor quick sticks. Otherwise, understand that at different times of the month, the smell is going to change. There's this idea that, you know, pussies smell fishy. Some of them are a little bit more fishy than others. Some of them smell meaty. Some of them smell musky. Some of them smell...
sweet.
Sweet. Just like different cocks have different smells. The thing is, genitals are one of the few parts of our body that are perpetually wrapped up all day in your knickers, in your jocks. So obviously, I mean, it's that thing of if you can wear cotton knickers, then that's a great thing to do. Or wear
none.
No knickers. Exactly. Yeah. So there's that too. If you do have to wear nylon knickers because they're particularly pretty, and I think that's a really important thing to do, is wear knickers that you like. Alternate, or sort of, you'd have your nylon knickers on one day and then maybe don't wear some the day
you
after.
You can wear, there's some great panty liners too that will kind of help you breathe a bit more, I think.
Yeah, there are, but I also think a lot of that stuff is a myth that we're sold these perfumes and we're sold this and we're sold that. Panty liners are good if you've got your fancy knickers on and you don't want to drip onto them, because sometimes there are chemicals in our natural secretions that have almost a bleaching effect. So if you've got your sexy black knickers on and they have a cotton gusset, which hopefully they do, sometimes the chemicals that drip out of our pussies can have a slightly bleaching effect, and you might not want to get – you just don't want to ruin your fancy new knickers, which is cool. So then a panty liner might be helpful for that kind of thing. But other than tampons for basic use of you know, using during your period for convenience, if that's what you're into – pussy perfumes, douches, all that stuff, no. Flat out, no. You don't need it. If your pussy smells that bad, you might be infected. Go and see a doctor. Otherwise, look at altering your diet. Look at altering your washing routine and just washing on the outside. You don't need to wash on the inside. These are old myths and they're garbage.
Okay, stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
Tips for stimulation.
Okay. There's sort of three main points, I would say, with stimulation. Have a look. Have a look at your own bits. When you are masturbating, if you do, and I would encourage women to do it, have a look at, as you're touching yourself, the different bits that feel good. You don't necessarily have to know the names, although you can if you want to, but understand the different bits of your body that feel good. Looking at your clitoris, some are bigger than others. Some of them really protrude. Some of them are barely visible, but they all have sensation to varying degrees. If you imagine that your clitoris is a clock face, and it has 12 points around it, try putting pressure on different parts as you're going around it, at the 1 o'clock point, at the 2 o'clock point, 3 o'clock point. Often for a lot of women, the 6 o'clock point is where there is the most sensation. So have a little experiment at the different points of your clitoris that are more stimulating. And so then if you are with a partner, you can actually have a better idea of being able to tell them which bit of it you like to touch, how much pressure you like, experimenting with different levels of friction from no lube to lots of lube. That kind of thing is part of the exploration.
This podcast is brought to you by Pushy Women, an all-female speaking event which is part of Melbourne Bike Fest. Come and hear Noni Hazelhurst, Ethel Chopp, Clementine Ford, Emily Zoe Baker, Nellie Thomas, Stella Young, Anna Crean, Jess Maguire, and Catherine Devaney. Share their hilarious, moving, and jaw-dropping stories of life on two wheels. Wednesday, March 14th, Malthouse Theatre, 7 p.m. To buy tickets, go to www.melbournebikefest.com.au/program. You'll find Pushy Women under Satellite Events.
Now, there is this big myth that it's harder for women to have orgasms than men. That there's more women out there who can't orgasm than men.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal? What's the scoop?
Mm.
Is this true? If so, why? If not, why not?
Mm-hmm. We experience orgasms in different ways. Some of us have an easier time getting there than others. Some say that they've never ever had orgasms. Some have orgasms at the drop of a hat. And there's different kinds of orgasms. So there's vaginal orgasms, Which are the G-spot orgasms, which we'll talk about in a second. Some of the most common ones that that most women have are clitoral orgasms, which is often the first orgasm that any woman will experience, will be a clitoral orgasm, because it's one of the easiest to access. And it's one of the ones, I suppose, that we hear most often talking about it. So again, for women who can't have orgasms or don't have orgasms, I would be more inclined to say there's a range of, again, options that they can look at with the help of an expert, or, again, just through trial and error, their own sort of practice. I would need to sort of look at what's going on in the background there as well. What are the messages that they got about sexuality? Mm. Where is it? Because I think a lot of the time, as long as the pipes are working, and in 99.9% of cases they are, and that's great because it means that what we've got to work with is the psychological and the emotional blockages behind why the orgasms aren't happening. And, you know, the statistics are pretty good to say that most women, most of the time, can achieve an orgasm of some kind. There are different kinds of orgasms.
So we've got, there's vaginal orgasms, there's clitoral orgasms. What else have we got?
So, well, the vaginal orgasm is the G-spot orgasm. So, and for, I think a lot of people have probably heard of the G-spot. They might not know what it is. Another name for it is the urethral sponge. And this is an area just inside the vagina about two knuckles in, as you as it were, and it's just behind the pubic bone. So if you're lying down on your back and you've got your legs open and you've got your fingers or someone else's fingers inside you, it's about two knuckles in, and it's on the front wall behind the pubic bone.
So you're hooking up.
You're hooking up. So you're kind of making a bit of a, like a come here gesture. Now, you know that you've hit the spot generally because if you understand that the inside of your vagina feels like the inside of your cheek, if you just run your... So that's what vagina feels like. The G-spot area, and it's a spot, it's not a button, so it's a general kind of region. And in different women, again, it's slightly different. It feels a bit more like the roof of your mouth. The skin is slightly...
Oh,
it's a slightly different texture.
Yeah, okay.
So that's how you know where it is, more or less. Now, the other thing with vaginas that a lot of people don't understand is that vaginas generally respond to pressure rather than stroking, if that makes sense. So the skin, the first third of the vagina is reasonably sensitive. But once you go in further, the ability to actually feel things from skin-to-skin contact alone is somewhat desensitized, which is why often if you're wearing a tampon, you can't feel it. But if you're wearing those, you know, those rubber, the silicone balls with the bells inside, with the weights inside them, you can feel those. And that's because of the pressure that they're putting on the walls of the vagina, whereas a tampon doesn't do that. It just sort of sits there. So something that people need to understand, particularly around if they want to start exploring vaginal orgasms, that vaginas respond to pressure rather than stroking in the way that a clitoris might. So... G-spot stimulation, again, you have to be, if you're working with somebody else or just doing it to yourself, experiment with pressure, experiment with speed, experiment with friction, how much lube do you like, all of that kind of thing. And you'll know the area because it will, once you start really stimulating it, it'll start to give you a very, very deep, pleasurable sensation that's quite distinct from a clitoral sensation.
How would you describe the difference?
Where the clitoral stimulation sits, I'd say it's a kind of lighter feeling. It would be, I would almost describe it as something to akin that you would be feeling in your chest, whereas a G-spot orgasm and G-spot stimulation is a much more guttural, deep, I don't want to necessarily say profound, that I'm certainly not saying it's better either. It's just a different sensation that resonates at a much deeper level of your sexual body, if that makes sense.
Can you have a vaginal orgasm via clitoral stimulation?
Interesting you should ask that. There's been a bit of research done actually on the scientific aspect of female anatomy lately, and they have worked out that the clitoris is actually a much, much, much bigger organ than just what protrudes outside of the body.
Right.
So if you imagine, and I know people can't see this, so this is, see, if you imagine your clitoris is here, we're looking at a side view. Clitoris is here, that's the vagina, and that's the anus here. The clitoris, the bulb, is the bit that sticks out that we can all see, but there are two legs. that come down like this, which when you're in a deep state of arousal, you can actually feel them. If, again, you slow down and take the time to do it, they almost feel like a really taut guitar string or a really taut washing line string. I'm thinking of various images that you can almost twang it, and it sits between the big lips and the small lips. So that is where they call them the legs of the clitoris come down. Now, new images are showing us, new x-rays are showing us that they actually sit around the vaginal canal. And so through the clitoral stimulation, when you're having a clitoral orgasm, your pussy is pulsating like this. And what the understanding is now is that while it is also the vaginal walls doing it, that it's the clitoral legs actually squeezing on it as well. And they actually go right down to the anus, which is another topic that we're going to talk about later. But it can mean that entire area comes alive with a clitoral orgasm. When you combine a clitoral orgasm with a G-spot orgasm, that's when worlds start to collide and planets start opening up and people start describing this notion of seeing God, which is probably not a good analogy to sit with an atheist, but it's that kind
seeing
of
Christopher Hitchens.
It's that universal experience that transcends the physical realm, I guess. So this is what people start talking about when they are having these very, very heightened kind of orgasms where it engages not just the clitoris, but the whole body becomes involved in it at that point. So, and I think that kind of taps into what you were suggesting earlier about altering your levels of intelligence and altering your levels of awareness around sexuality, that the more you experience and the more that you play with it and the more that you learn about yourself, the more awareness you have of your entire being.
Now, female ejaculation, it's actually banned in Australia as refused classification, female ejaculation in pornography, which is, of course, you can just open up the internet and you have the whole world there. But as far as the Australian classification system goes, they have refused female ejaculation classification on the grounds that it's a water sport, that it's urine, which, A, it's not, but B, what's the problem with urine if it's consenting adults and it's safe and it's in their own bedroom? There's no issue there. Tell us about female ejaculation. Is it true?
Yes, it is true. And I think, again, where a lot of the confusion comes from is that when men ejaculate, well, you can actually see it happening, you can see it spurting out, and almost always it's connected with orgasm. In women, female ejaculation and orgasm are two separate things. You can have an orgasm without ejaculating, and you can ejaculate without having an orgasm. They're
really
not the same thing. Yeah. So women who can and do ejaculate, it's a pleasurable sensation, but it's not an orgasm. And depending on, again, how much practice you've had with it and the way to access this sensation, if it's something that you think you want to play with, is, again, through the G-spot, through the urethral sponge, applying pressure to it, applying different amounts of pressure, different amounts of friction will, in some cases, and not all women are apparently capable of achieving female ejaculation. It depends on a range of issues. And again, because very little is still understood about how this happens and why it happens. Again, some women feel that they're missing out if they can't do it. Again, it's about the normalizing it for certain women. Not everybody can do it, but I would certainly encourage people to practice it if it's something that they wanted to experiment with, because even if you think you can't do it, you might surprise yourself and find that you can in the right circumstances, in the right situation. Good sex is about practicing.
With female ejaculation, which was apparently a myth, but it's not.
It's not a myth.
If you are ejaculating when you orgasm, are you having a G-spot orgasm? Can you ejaculate if you have a clitoral orgasm?
Yes, it's possible. All of those things are possible, but because ejaculating is not connected to orgasm, you might not be having any kind of orgasm at all while you're ejaculating. So a lot of women, in order to achieve this kind of sensation of ejaculating, they'll need the G-spot pressure, generally speaking, that would be a given, and often that they need to assist this process by bearing down. So it's that sense of that your PC muscle, the muscle that you use to control when you're having a piss, if you squeeze that in and then you release it and then you actually bear down, if you can understand that kind of sensation, that can often facilitate the process of getting it moving. So a combination of lots and lots of G-spot stimulation and this sense of bearing down can bring that kind of an experience on for those who want to have it. And in some women, it's just a little bit of fluid. And again, it's about this, what is this fluid? It doesn't smell. It has a mild kind of body smell, but it's certainly not, again, an offensive smell. If yours smells particularly bad, it could be the sign of an infection. Again, you need to go to a doctor. But generally, it's sort of clear to a little bit milky. It's virtually odorless. There can be lots of it. There might just be a little bit. So if you're experimenting with it and you're not sure and you're worried about getting your mattress damaged, put down a towel or something, because in some women they can lose like up to a cup at a time, which is quite a lot. So, and that, which is where this idea that, oh, she's pissed herself when she's having sex comes from, because in some women it can literally be a cupful that comes out at once. Mm. It's not urine. It's ejaculate. And a tablespoon, a cup. It's not a competition. You know?
You were saying that there's scientific research that's saying that not all women can.
Mm.
I've actually read research that says women all do every time, but in some cases it's just a tiny drop. So you miss it within. Yeah. Now, with female ejaculation, would it happen with somebody's first orgasm? Are some people always ejaculators, always ejaculate the same amount, or some people do it sometimes or smaller amounts or bigger amounts?
Again, it's as varied as it is with individuals. Right. There is no normalizing of it.
So some people do it all the same in the same amount. Some people do it occasionally and different amounts. Some people have always had it with every orgasm. Some people have never had it.
Yeah. And, I mean, and often you can have it and you don't necessarily have to have an orgasm, or you can at the same time. It depends. Some women do it without even thinking about it. So this whole process I've described about squeezing and bearing down, some women don't ever have to do that. They've done it from the first time they had sex. They just have that kind of body. So again, it's about understanding that if you can do it really easily, or it does happen really easily, that's okay. And if it never happens at all, that's also okay.
Where does it come out of? Where does the ejaculate come out of?
Okay. It's stimulated by pressing on the G-spot, pressing on the urethral sponge. Some of it does come out of the urethra and some of it does come out of the vagina. So the secretions that come from the vagina, which are much more, slimy, more like saliva in their texture, whereas female ejaculate has the consistency of urine, which is, again, why people think that that's what it is. It's very, very watery, it's very thin, whereas pussy juice in general is much more viscous and much more slimy and slippery.
I've got a vested interest in this because I'm a squirter.
Oh.
And I haven't always been a squirter. Uh-huh. I now realise I squirted once very late in my pregnancy with my middle child after orgasming, because I thought my waters had broken and they hadn't. And that would kind of make sense. I was 40 and I wasn't doing anything particularly different. I was just single. I'd become single for the first time in about 16 years. And it was amazing and a fright and a shock, and I wasn't entirely sure what it was because I'd heard about it, but, you know, it was a myth and I'd never seen it. I didn't really know anything about it. I mean, it deepened the orgasm.
Mm.
But for people who are squirters, and these may be people who've never had sex with a partner, how do you deal with, because I had to deal with this myself, when you know you're a squirter and you have a new partner and there is, firstly, there's penetrative intercourse, whether it's vaginal or anal, and saying, listen, I'm a squirter, I just need to explain it to you. And then there's also with oral sex, how do you deal with that? Explaining that to a partner, or whether you're going to squirt in their mouth.
Well, there's kind of, I suppose, not really an easy way around it other than having the conversation. And depending on the caliber of that relationship, whether it's going to be a long-term relationship or a one-night stand, it's up to you how you're going to approach it and to what degree you feel compelled to explore that kind of stuff. So
I don't think I can really squirt unless I feel really comfortable. And if I was with a partner it wasn't terribly serious, it was just I would squirt. I just wouldn't be relaxed enough.
Exactly. So, I mean, the options around that would be if you're really, really worried about it and you're just sort of in a one-night stand or a casual situation, you might want to suggest using something like a dental dam, which would be a good thing to do anyway.
Or you could try doggy style, or there'd be styles where it would be less visual, it would be less noticeable, and so then if it did happen, you wouldn't.
And I think the only time, I mean, if you're going to be using condoms, the risk of any kind of illness or diseases being transmitted are going to be minimised significantly by a condom anyway, regardless of whether anyone's ejaculating or not. But I think really the biggest risk is through sort of finger penetration, not risk, the biggest concern for that kind of thing, just from an awkwardness point of view, is finger penetration and squirting us all over somebody's hand. Or if you really are going to be squirting in someone's mouth, you probably would need to let them know that that's something that might happen and how do they feel about it. If they actively say, you know what, I'm not cool with that, then I think it's your responsibility to go, all right, and have some control around it and sort of shift the activity if you feel like that's about to start happening and go, hey, I think I'm about to, you know, let's shift and do something else. And that way that they at least have some consciousness and consent in the fact that they don't want your pussy juice all over their face.
I've always wanted to have a multiple orgasm. Mm-hmm. I've kind of had, you know, like it seemed like 2.5 the other day.
Mm-hmm.
What are they and how can I get one?
Multiple orgasms can come in all shapes and sizes, all forms. Again, for a lot of women, when they experience clitoral orgasms, they can generally only have one at a time because then afterwards to touch the clitoris, it's just way, way, way too sensitive.
And it's like, you know, let me come and then get the fuck out of there. Yeah.
Which is where something like G-spot orgasms, you can actually have a few of those in a row before and still maintain the sensitivity of your clitoris. Of your clitoris. So that's something, I suppose, where a lot of that notion of a multiple orgasm can come from. Again, each woman is different. Each woman's experience of her sexuality is going to be different in that way. Breathing is a big thing in terms of extending orgasms. We have this thing that when we're stressed or we're anxious or we're, you know, concerned for whatever reason, we tend to hold on. If you want to really extend that pleasurable sensation, breathing through it, and not breathing like you're giving birth kind of breathing, but just long, slow, deep breaths and really getting into your body, getting out of your head and getting really into your body, that can often extend the duration and the quality and the depth of the orgasm as well. Having multiple orgasms through quickies, while they can happen, it's very, very unlikely. It's uncommon, I guess, in that way. So it's something that I think for a lot of women, you kind of got to put aside the time. Again, it's about practice. You need to practice these things. I believe that everyone is capable of anything that they actually really want to do, provided that they practice and they put in the dedication.
This has come... this is our first podcast and there's going to be many more you'll be thrilled to know. This has come over and over again in what you've been saying. You have to practice, you have to put time aside, you have to try different things and devote yourself to it. So at times when you're talking, you're going, all women are different and you've got to do different things. This is a bit of an educational, it's a self-education, it's a self-teaching thing and that you should be open to different implements, different stimulations, visual stimulations, different lube. There's, you know, tip I can give people out there. I was not allergic, but some of those warming lubes all made me a bit ouchy. Yeah. And it was only when I was sitting through an amazing discussion at a Griefline conference with a woman who deals with sex and cancer that she was talking about the silicone lubes and then the other lubes and said that they're made of kiwi fruit. And I'm allergic to kiwi fruit, which is why I was a bit ouchy. So one of the things I think that all 13-year-olds should get for Christmas or their birthday is a bottle of really good silicone lube.
Absolutely, because not to use with silicone toys, I have to say that.
Oh,
the silicone lube eats away at the silicone toys. So if you have got a silicone toy, which is ideally what you want, you put a condom on it and then you can use the silicone lube with it, because otherwise the silicone and the silicone eat away at each other. So water-based lube, but sugarless, fragranceless, as pure as you can get it, is the best way to go for toys. But for cocks and condoms and all that kind of stuff, silicone lube's fantastic.
Here we go. Top tips. No silicone lube with silicone toys. Cindy Darnell, thank you very much.
My
cannot
pleasure.
Get enough. Talking sexy here. I want to. We don't have a name for the podcast yet, which doesn't really matter. I want to call it gagging for it. Get a hard one up your game on moles. We're not quite sure. But it's about, my friends, this is just about pleasure. This is about sex positive. And the reason that I am so keen to do this with Cindy, I'd heard about Cindy and the work that she's done as the creator and founder of the Pleasure Salon. And just the tiny fraction of connection I've had with the Pleasure Salon and Cindy and being at the Christmas party and doing stand-up has made me realise I always thought about the sex positive message as something which was in the, you know, gay, lesbian, transgender, intergender, bisexual world. It's made me realise that the heteros need this message more than anybody else because it's like, hey, we're doing the right sex. We're the heterosexuals. We don't need to expand ourselves. It's like, you don't need to, but you would benefit greatly from it. Yourself personally, your relationship, your body with your relationship with your body, with your emotions and with your intellect. So thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Come on. Let's talk about sex,
baby. Let's talk about you. Audio production by Anthony Artman. Artsystems@gmail.com.